This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamir.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast. From the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River. From the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior. This is AK. This week on AK, the second in our series of shows on Alaska's 50th anniversary as a state. We'll look back on some of the big ideas in the nation's biggest state, plus the rise of the fur industry.
I tell everybody, it's just like Christmas every day, to go out and see what's under the tree, see what's in your trap.
And we'll meet a pioneering Alaskan aviator. That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Steve Heimel. It's not easy to look back over 50 years and get a feel for what those statehood years were really like, what everyday concerns were on people's minds. For me, in my rural hometown in the eastern United States, the dominant concerns were cars and girls and rock and roll, pretty much like any other 15-year-old boy. I certainly would never have pictured myself sitting in Alaska 50 years in the future, looking back. We weren't even sure we'd be around that long. Russia had the H-bomb and Sputnik had gone up. Nuclear annihilation was a very real possibility. We were still worried about communist spies, and having a general like Dwight Eisenhower in the White House made us feel a little more secure. It really did. Post-war prosperity was making our parents a little giddy and us maybe a little spoiled, really, but with high expectations. We had much better educational opportunities than our parents did, and America needed scientists. Already there was polio vaccine and the beginnings of shopping malls. Our scientists were looking for peaceful uses of the powers of the atom. In this sweep of optimism, adding a couple more stars to the American flag seemed like a perfectly natural extension of the taming of the Wild West our movies portrayed. Racism and segregation were everyday realities. Prejudice was routine. The civil rights struggle was still a few years away. Native Americans were called Indians, and the main thing I remember about them was that cigarettes and gasoline were cheaper in their towns. I don't think I realized there were Indians in Alaska. I learned about Eskimos as an especially exotic form of primitive people like the Bushmen in Africa, likely candidates for missionaries sent forth by clubs at the churches like my grandma belonged to. I don't know if I even knew then there had been a gold rush in Alaska. I knew about the one in California. It, too, seemed to be a part of the Wild West. I dreamed of living on the West Coast with beaches and movie stars, or maybe to the north fighting forest fires and cutting down trees, but that would be Seattle, where the totem poles were. Totem poles and forests in Alaska were beyond my Pennsylvania imagining. Walt Disney was making nature movies in those years, and one was about the Arctic, the wolves, the bears, and the salmon, and of course the lemmings jumping off the cliff. Yes, Alaska was a kind of dream back then. How did you even get there? Boats, I guess, or bombers. In those years, passenger aviation was still DC-3s, and the interstate highway system still mostly a dream. Even Alaska's big earthquake hadn't happened yet. In Alaska itself, imaginations were working overtime in the 1950s. In the brand new and biggest state of Alaska, big ideas got truly huge. Many grand schemes centered on the new state's abundant natural resources, others on its remote location, a factor that sometimes frustrated scrutiny of some outrageous government projects. As AK's Ellen Lockyer reports, some truly wacky ideas didn't make the cut. But a few of them did.
Some schemes became famous, some infamous. Let's take a look at the notorious failures first. The only thing sillier than the promotion of a Teflon Dome-covered city at Denali was the proposal of a second domed city to be dubbed Seward's Success across Knik Arm from Anchorage. Then U.S. Senator Mike Gravel is credited with the Denali Dome scheme, something he denies now.
It's an interesting distortion, and that's a price I pay for being a maverick.
Gravel writes that one off as bad press. He says he actually wanted to promote tourism.
In fact, I was advocating something that is very, very important to Alaska, and it subsequently came to pass. And that is that the most important industry for the state of Alaska is tourism.
Well, Seward's Success never got off the drawing board either, although a move to build a causeway across Knik Arm to Point McKenzie was promoted as early as 1958 by Anchorage's Chamber of Commerce at the behest of one Ken Hinchey. Hinchey wanted to build an earth and rock-filled dam across the inlet to block the ice flowing out of the Knik River from clogging the port of Anchorage. Strangely enough, Hinchey was in the concrete business. The wild country of Alaska spawned some pretty wild ideas before and after statehood. One of the most ambitious was the Rampart Dam, a huge hydroelectric project pushed by Senator Ernest Greening. The dam was to block the Yukon River near Rampart, creating a 10,000-square-mile lake some 400 miles long. Of course, that would have had a bit of an impact on local salmon runs and wildlife, but hey, the plan was to generate 5,000 megawatts of electricity to attract steel mills to the trackless wilderness of Alaska. The Rampart Dam idea was abandoned, but other mega projects were hatching like salmon spawn. The man who brainstormed a railroad tunnel beneath the Bering Strait also dreamed of a water link to the lower 48.
See, I was going to catch water where it runs into the ocean, but not all of it, so the fish can keep going. They're going to have a dam there. Pipeline would be below the dam.
Governor and visionary Wally Hickel wanted to build a pipeline from Alaska to California that would carry fresh water to thirsty Los Angeles.
They're going to run out of water. That's going to be possibly the most precious resource on Earth this century.
That plan flopped, but a similar and much scarier plan concocted by Los Angeles captains of industry actually gathered support. The North American Water and Power Alliance, or NWAPA, was supposed to create a system of pipelines, canals, and inland lakes stretching from Alaska through British Columbia and California to Texas. Preposterous? Ask UAF historian Terrence Cole.
Wally Hickel's water pipeline is just a tiny subset of NWAPA, just a fraction of it, actually. That by itself would have been the biggest construction project in the history of the world, just that, let alone the damming of all these rivers and the $100 billion in 1964 dollars that it was estimated to cost. It's predicated on one idea, that the North has excess water. Who decided it was excess water, excess for what?
NWAPA would have dammed every major river between Anchorage and Vancouver, but Cole says even that wasn't the craziest scheme out there.
In the 1950s and 60s, there was a Soviet proposal to dam Bering Strait. Back then, part of the idea was to sort of melt the polar ice cap and give Soviet shipping an advantage in world markets by changing the temperature of the Arctic Ocean.
Global warming, anyone? One really awful idea, Project Chariot, was proposed by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission in 1959. The unbelievable plan to detonate a hydrogen bomb near Kivalina to blast out a deep water port was actually endorsed by the Alaska State Legislature. Although Project Chariot died, actual nuclear tests were carried out on Amchitka Island in the late 60s and early 1970s. Gravel fought the tests.
About a mile underneath the ocean, they created a chamber the size of a football field full of irradiated debris that had a half-life of 1,000 years. Now, this was in a seismically active area.
Despite threats to the environment, the big ideas did not stop coming. One of the biggest? TAPS, or the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Gravel supported TAPS.
At the time of the Alaska pipeline, I had an amendment to have double bottoms and to have radar controlling Prince William Sound, which were defeated not only by the oil interest, but by the Coast Guard.
TAPS, of course, shaped the state we know today and brought with it sweeping social legislation like ANCSA and ANILCA, not to mention oil revenues to fill the state's coffers. Now that TAPS is running low, it seems the logical next move is already on the horizon, a natural gas pipeline to stretch from Prudhoe Bay through Canada to the lower 48. Big state, big ideas. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
People migrating to Alaska in the days leading up to statehood came by many different routes, some by a long, slow slog up the muddy, treacherous Alcan Highway, some by prop plane, a trip that took more than 8 hours from Seattle, and some by boat. Merchant Marine Eldon Galeer came in 1946 when he jumped ship in Anchorage. In the 50s, he lived in Anchorage, and he wasn't real sure that statehood was a good idea.
There was a lot of pros and cons, you know, about statehood or like Virginia Commonwealth. And if I remember right, you could mark either one on the ballot. I'm not sure about that anymore. It's been too many years ago. But I know after reading what I did and whatnot, I went for the Commonwealth. I didn't go for statehood. And not that I say it was a mistake or anything, but it's sure made a big change of things. The people had better control. To me, at that time, the people would have better control over their taxation. That was one reason I went for it. And, of course, without a doubt, what's happening in our legislature today proves that I was thinking right. Well, of course, then we got a guys in there in the federal legislature as Young and as Stevens. And now I'm not tooting my horn for either one or both of them, but they have brought a lot of money into this state, which has helped us. And one great thing is the paved roads. There's not very many people around anymore that can remember, I think it was the summer of 48, that it was so dry and hot, and with this volcanic dust all over the place, why, there was a dust cloud hung right over Anchorage. I used to fly a little bit in them days, and man, you'd leave Merrill Field or, like when I first came here, the park strip out there at 9th Avenue was the airfield. Why, you'd come back into Anchorage, and man, you could see that pall of dust hanging over Anchorage. And I remember your nose and throat was burning all the time and everything from it. And, of course, now we got so much pavement that dust is not gone, but it's sure cut down. Living in Anchorage, your troubles was your neighbor's troubles. And everybody kind of took care of everybody else. I can remember my first cabin was on 13th and Gamble, which was called G in them, East G in them days. And if you got sick or if you run out of fuel oil in the wintertime when it was cold and your neighbor had a little extra oil, why, he wouldn't mind filling a couple of 5-gallon cans of oil and bringing them over to you.
We'll find out more about Eldon's life in early Anchorage in just a bit. Still to come on AK, we'll meet a pioneering Alaska aviator.
He had asked several men to fly over the North Pole with him, and not one pilot would. I was the only one.
Welcome back to AK. I'm Steve Heimel. Merchant Marine Eldon Galeer jumped ship in Anchorage in 1946 to make good on a promise to his sweetheart that he would stay on land for a year, after which she made good on a promise to marry him. As we heard from Eldon before the break, he settled in Anchorage and began living the life of an onshore married man.
I shot my first bull moose down there where Cal Worthington Ford is now. Because I was out flying, and I come coasting in to Merrill Field, and I looked down, and here's this big bull standing there down there by the creek. And I landed and went home and out to my cabin on 13th. And, of course, by that time, I got a wife. My girl lived many years, finally decided to marry me. I'd stayed on the beach a year, as she asked me, from sailing. And so I told her I was going down to get a moose, and I did, and I went down and I shot this nice big bull, and I packed that moose all the way from, I guess what would be 19th or 20th, all the way back to 13th Street to my cabin. And I got tired of waiting in Chester Creek because it was so cold. And so I packed a 3x12 plank down there and threw it across the creek at a narrow place. They had a rock out near the middle to help brace the plank. And my kids fished off of that plank for years because there was just below that plank, there was a eddy in the creek. And there was always fish in that eddy. And for years, you could drive past over Chester Creek down there on the when they finally cut the G Street through and see that plank laying across the creek. And then when they put in what they call the green belt, they took my plank out, and I haven't seen it since.
Eldon and Rose Galear live in a quiet cabin in the Mat-Su. The vast numbers of densely furred animals along the Aleutian Chain and on the Pribilof Islands of the Bering Sea had drawn Russians to Alaska in the 1700s. At the time of statehood, the U.S. government was harvesting about 80,000 fur seals from the Pribilofs each year. In the rest of Alaska, fur was an industry, but it was also a way of life. By the 1950s and 60s, fur prices had actually plummeted, forcing some trappers to give up. But for many Alaskans, especially in rural areas, trapping remained an important source of income. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Red Beeman doesn't have any trouble remembering the first time he set eyes on Alaska. It was 1951 when he pulled into Whittier on an Air Force ship. It was June, but there was still plenty of snow around.
And I looked up at all the mountains with the waterfalls, and I said, this is it. This has got to be it.
Beeman spent 3 years at Elmendorf and then went right to a trap line on the Eagle River. He had no experience as a trapper, but he knew right away it was the life for him.
Surprisingly, Eagle River Valley was a really good trap line at that time. It was good for mink and otter and a few wolverine and a lot of coyotes.
But by the 1950s, even a good trap line wasn't very lucrative. Fur prices had been dropping since the 1930s, and Beeman says there weren't very many trappers left near Anchorage. He supplemented his fur income with commercial fishing in Cook Inlet in the summer and big game guiding in the fall. Former Board of Game member Jim Reardon says that was a juggling act most trappers had to manage.
There were some full-time trappers, that is, they made their living at it, but mostly it was a side issue, and people in the villages, of course, had to depend on fur for their income because there was no other way of making money.
Dean Wilson knows that village way of life well. He grew up in Northway and was snaring rabbits and squirrels by the time he was 8 years old. He continued trapping when he established his own home near Kenny Lake and eventually became one of the most respected fur buyers in the state. He says he enjoyed the trapping life, but like many rural residents, it was all he knew.
That was one of the few ways there was of generating some income. And so virtually everybody out in rural Alaska was trappers. I would say somewhere between 50% and 80%.
Trappers had a lot of options on where to sell their furs. Red Beeman says he would bring his carefully prepared catch to buyers in Anchorage.
And they were real characters, I'll tell you. They were all, you'd take your fur in, and I prided myself in how well I handled my furs. They were skin clean, and the fur was clean, and they were well dried and everything. And you'd take them in, and they'd just about throw them on the floor and tromp on them, say, oh, these are no good, you know, and trying to downgrade you right from the start.
Beeman says he had good experiences the few times he sold to David Green, whose store still stands on 4th Avenue today. Green died in 1971, and now the company belongs to his son, Perry. Upstairs from the shop, a small staff makes and repairs fur coats on sewing machines that look like they haven't changed since statehood. Perry Green started learning the business from his father in the 1950s and set off on his own as a buyer in Alaska's first years as a state. He traveled to remote villages, mostly by plane and dog sled, and had plenty of adventures along the way, including 3 plane crashes. He says he always tried to offer the best prices.
The village elders would be first in line to sell their skins. And if they sold them to you, everybody else sold their skins. But if they felt that their price wasn't right, you had a difficult time in that village.
Green says he used to advertise on KICY radio in Nome, asking trappers to save their skins for him.
I would always conclude my broadcast with E-Yum-C Kanaholic. Someone in Macoriac once said to me, why do you say you're an alcoholic at the end of your broadcast? And what E-Yum-C Kanaholic is thank you in Siberian Eskimo. But I knew my advertising was working because this fellow felt sorry for me because he thought I was an alcoholic.
These days, Green has turned the day-to-day operation of the business over to his son and niece, but he talks about the store and all the old adventures with great affection. Red Beeman misses his days on a trap line, too.
I tell everybody it's just like Christmas every day to go out and see what's under the tree, see what's in your trap. And I've never been affected by the aspect of cruelty to animals. It's simply a means of making a livelihood.
That livelihood may have dropped off significantly, but it hasn't disappeared altogether. Red Beeman's son works a trap line near McGrath, and in recent years, it's been more lucrative. Fur prices have been on the rise again. For AK, I'm Annie Feit.
Transporting supplies, fuel, and people across Alaska presents logistical challenges that no doubt surpass what any other state has to deal with. The methods of moving things has gotten more efficient since statehood, but there are some basics that just don't change. AK's Lori Townsend takes us to the heart of Alaska's transport action, the Port of Anchorage.
Here you go, ma'am. Thank you. Welcome. Hi, how are you?
On a gloomy August afternoon, a surprising number of people stand in line at the Alaska Railroad headquarters in Anchorage, affably filing onto a waiting bus to take them on the summer's last tour of the ongoing expansion of the Port of Anchorage. Our tour guide, Steve, lays out the importance of the port to the residents and businesses of the state.
And if you're wearing it, eating it, drinking it, driving it, putting it in your gas tank, the likelihood is it came in here first. We probably pumped somewhere between $750 million and $1 billion into the state's economy between jobs that are generated out of just this activity down here at the port.
As we wind along the gravel road leading through the security gates to the flurry of port activity, Steve ticks off the numbers. 52,000 cars through the port each year, 4,400 containers offloaded twice each week, and a huge 135-acre expansion underway. Standing on an observation deck overlooking the massive vessels offloading cargo, it's hard to imagine that when the port started operations in 1961, there was a single berth and only 38,000 tons of cargo moved in that first year. Now, 400 million tons, or nearly 5 tons for every resident of Alaska, comes through the port annually. Horizon Line Safety Officer Brad Brown points to the gantry cranes offloading containers.
If this port goes down, what we're looking at is the state of Alaska also goes down. The average stores around here, the family, will have about 3 days' food supply.
The port expansion is another sign of the growing population in Alaska. Former Governor Bill Sheffield is the port director. Sheffield arrived in Alaska in 1953. He says the city of Anchorage has come a long way since statehood.
And that transportation has changed a lot, just in roads, roads down to the Kenai Peninsula that you didn't have before, road to Seward, which you didn't have when I first got here. The road towards Mount McKinley stopped at Big Lake. If you wanted to go to Nancy Lake, you had to take the train.
When Sheffield first came to Alaska with the Sears and Roebuck Company, he says it took 8 hours to fly from Seattle. And before statehood, when you flew out, you had to go through customs in Seattle.
And the poor customs person, you know, I felt sorry for him in a way because we'd all be yelling at him, we can pay taxes, but we can't vote for the president, and we have to clear customs, you know.
Seattle is still where much of the supplies for Alaska originate from. Linden Transport pioneered freight delivery up the Elkan Highway from the Seattle area in 1954. Linden Transport Sales Vice President Mike Oliver says the company has grown from a handful of employees and a truck in the 50s to a corporation with more than 1,500 employees.
We evolved into a
into an all-mode carrier over time, where we employ ships, barges, aircraft, hovercraft, the Alaska State Ferry, as well as still maintaining our highway routes.
Oliver says the actual work of moving things from point A to point B hasn't changed much in the business.
I used to say there hasn't been a lot of change, a lot of innovation since the Phoenicians. You know, we went from sail to steam. We went from hand trucks to forklifts.
But he says a big change came with the advent of fax machines, so orders and cost estimates didn't have to mosey along through the mail. He says what customers used to accept would take days now is expected in hours.
One time I asked that question of somebody, and they said, well, I'm not in a hurry. Tomorrow is fine. That's our business today. Everything happens at the 11th hour, and everybody needs information right now.
Oliver says 95% of Linden Transport's business is with Alaska, and he says the company will continue to grow into the next 50 years, right along with Alaska's ever-expanding need for goods and services. For AK, I'm Lori Townsend.
Concern about Alaska's environment was one of the forces that led to statehood. Federal management had been a disaster for the fishing industry, and population growth had led to some localized depletion of wild game. As AK Scott Burton tells us now, environmental concerns in Alaska were a significant force in the budding environmental movement nationally.
At 80 years old, Jim King is a pioneer in the Juneau conservation community. He moved to Alaska in 1949 when he was 21. His new book, Attending Alaska's Birds, A Wildlife Pilot's Story, outlines his career as a pilot and game manager for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says early conservation efforts in Alaska were inspired by failed gold miners who took up trapping instead.
One of the tricks the unscrupulous trappers would do is kill a big animal, cut it open, and liberally scatter strychnine pellets in the carcass, and the foxes would come along and feed on these strychnine pellets, and also the bears and the ravens and all sorts of other animals. And then the guy would come back and pick up the foxes in a few days before they spoiled, but the thing would go on poisoning animals for months.
King says exploiting wildlife led to decreasing game populations.
You know, there were dog trails between the communities. There was a mail route from Fairbanks to Nome, and other people used those trails, and roadhouses sprung up along those trails, and often all they served was moose meat for dogs or people. And moose were disappearing, and that was a problem, and caribou the same way.
With help from the director of the Biological Survey and longtime Alaska conservation advocate Edward Nelson, the 1925 Alaska Game Law was passed by Congress. Among other things, it outlawed beaver hunting, protected cow moose, and required drugstores to record who they sold poisons to. Nelson is also credited with bringing Alfred Bailey and wildlife biologist Olaus Murie to Alaska, who later contributed to the creation of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. King says the game laws worked well. As Alaska's population swelled after World War II, he says much of the game had recovered, a situation that over time drew the enthusiastic support of organized hunters.
They had a very strong interest in conservation, and although it's not well remembered now, the Tanana Valley sportsmen and the territorial sportsmen both were strong supporters of the early efforts to establish the Arctic Wildlife Refuge.
Alaskan issues played a major role in the growth of the national environmental movement, too, particularly in the years just after statehood passed. Alaska writer Dan O'Neill is the author of Firecracker Boys, a book about the Atomic Energy Commission's attempt to detonate atomic bombs in northern Alaska. It was a plan advanced by the so-called father of the H-bomb, Edward Teller.
To create an instant harbor on the coast of Alaska by
burying a series of thermonuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs, and blowing them all off at once. And that would create a gigantic, maybe 2 miles long, keyhole-shaped crater. And the sea would then rush in and fill the crater and make this instant harbor.
And Jim King remembers another big proposal that mobilized Alaskans and attracted attention from national conservation organizations.
The new senator for Alaska decided that in order to get some economy here, we needed to dam up the Yukon and make electric power. And those two things kind of stimulated a new type of organization, I guess what you'd call conservation organizations, or sometimes characterized as environmental organizations. Not directly sportsmen, but people with a deep concern.
People like pilot Ginny Wood. She's almost 90 and was among a group of five people in 1959 that testified to Alaska's new senator, Bob Bartlett, about the potential Arctic Wildlife Refuge.
I was flying for a living, and I had done a lot of bush flying up there, so I knew the territory pretty well. And so did Celia Hunter. And then there was Bob Whedon, who worked for Fish and Game then.
After the testimony, Wood remembers planting the seeds of Alaska's own conservation group.
We were out in the hallway of the building where we had had this. And they said, you know what? The Sierra Club or the Wilderness Society or the National Wildlife Society, we don't want outsiders telling us what we should do with our land in Alaska. Why don't there be some Alaskans and some natives have a say in it? And that's how it started.
The Alaska Conservation Society organized in 1960, the same year the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge got its start. Now, almost 50 years later, hundreds of organizations concerned with Alaska's environment lie across the state, vigilant to prevent the next 21st century version of strychnine animal poisoning or atomically produced harbors. For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
Still to come on this edition of AK, cutthroat competition among bush pilots.
I was called into their office and they offered to buy me out. And I said, you know, I've been a loner all my life and I don't intend to change. So, well, then we're going to put you out of business. We're going to fly wingtip to wingtip. And that was the exact words.
Welcome back to AK. I'm Steve Heimel. In the 1950s, healthcare in rural Alaska was primitive. The Indian Health Service did have village health aides, but it was a far cry from the sophisticated system in place today, where many regional clinics are connected to urban hospitals with computers and telemedicine. In those days, if a health aide needed help, she called on the shortwave radio or used the phone.
And I was usually the one that took the call.
Gloria Park came to Alaska in 1957 to work for the Indian Health Service. She worked with health aides and would arrange help for those who needed it. That meant getting an airplane to the patient and coaching the health aide to help them stabilize the patient with basic first aid. Some communities didn't have health aides, and Park, who traveled out the Aleutian Arm and back, would work with whomever to train them.
We had a health aid manual that for them to work on, but some of them couldn't read English. We left a limited supply of medicines and emergency use to use, and would individually tell each one how to do it.
Along with the medicines, Park left her phone number. Most of the people in rural Alaska dealt with medical emergencies themselves. During the 50s, Mia Bassler lived in Moses Point, a federal aviation station 100 miles east of Nome.
We had just had little Susie, and about a week later, comes a knock on the door on Sunday morning. He happened to be an FAA employee. He was a Native man, and his wife was having a baby. And she had come to the neighbors, to her friend who was a Native woman, and she needed help delivering that baby.
The problems facing Natives seeking health care in Nome wasn't just the remote nature of their communities. It was also institutional. There was no public health hospital in Nome, and the private hospital, Maynard McDougall Memorial, run by a Methodist missionary organization, had its own rules about admitting patients, as the story about a difficult birth told by Mia and John Bassler illustrates.
Well, that was quite an ordeal. Well, we delivered the baby. I wrapped it up and held it with the oven door open to keep it warm. And then a midwife came from town, and then John flagged down an Alaska airline plane to stop. And then that midwife and that little baby went to Nome to go to the hospital because it premature and it needed the oxygen. Now, the next is a sad story, but that's what happened. This is part of life. When these folks got to Nome and that woman wanted to put the baby in the hospital, they had to have $100 before they would admit the child. And then he told the station manager, there, get up there, give them the $100, I'll send it to you tomorrow, and so forth and so on. So then the next day they did accept the baby, but then it was too late and the little one died. So that was a very serious thing that happened there, yeah.
There was a doctor at the Nome Hospital, Dr. Langsam. He was anti-drink, that's for sure. And so somebody came in, if a native came in with a broken leg, he'd say, come back when you're sober.
Many Nome area natives have horror stories about the old private hospital. But time and effort changes many things. In the 1970s, the natives in the Nome region formed the Norton Sound Health Corporation. They took over the Nome Hospital in 1975, and their stated mission is to provide all patients with quality and respectful health care. Flying and pilots have long held a special place in Alaska, and they still do. With so much of the state accessible only by air, Alaskan bush pilots provide a vital service. But despite the essential nature of that service, it's never been an easy business. There are many reasons why bush pilots are so admired here. Johanna Urich has more.
The Alaska bush pilot is an iconic romantic image. Most are male, but women are not unknown in the state skies. They ferried planes to Russia during World War II, and one flew the first single-engine plane over the North Pole when her husband suggested the idea.
He had asked several men to fly over the North Pole with him, and not one pilot would. I was the only one.
It was 1963 when Ingrid Peterson headed over the North Pole with her husband navigating. She took off from Fairbanks in a tiny Cessna 205 loaded down with 200 extra gallons of fuel inside the cramped cabin.
The stall warning came on immediately after liftoff. It had a shrill sound. We were a flying bomb, that's for sure. If we had crashed right there, it would have been the end of it.
Ingrid landed 21 hours and 5 minutes later on Station Nord in Greenland. The rest is history. But it's the less spectacular and routine nature of Alaska aviation that makes it unique. There are more private pilots here than anywhere else in the nation. It's not unusual to see planes parked in front of lakeside homes or even in the front yards in some rural communities. But try running a small airline here. It's survival of the fittest in the skies, with the list of airlines that have failed a long one. Susan Bramstedt has spent most of her career working for a survivor who took the image of an Alaskan Eskimo in its tail all over the country. She says what others see as disasters or challenges are opportunities for airlines. She remembers there was more at stake during the construction of the Alaska pipeline than the flow of Alaskan crude.
I'd get a call from, I remember, Ernie Arp at Atlantic Richfield. Nicest guy. He'd call me and say, I really need a trip. I've got this much pipe, or I've got some drilling mud, or I've got some stuff. I got to get up there right away. And we had four Hercs that could haul in a huge amount of weight, just exactly what we needed to get that done. I'd send Ernie a bill. He'd send me the check. We'd go to the bank, and it would all just roll. But the survival of the company was on the line.
There is no safe airspace for a small airline in Alaska. Even one like Pan Air, which seems to have the business on the Alaska Peninsula, sewed up. The airline's founder, Orrin Siebert, grew up in Pilot Point and married into a large native family from Chignik. The business began when he started flying neighbors across Bristol Bay for emergency medical care. He made most of his money during the summer flying for fish processors, and during the rest of the year taking passengers from King Salmon to villages out the Alaska Peninsula and down the Aleutian Arm. But Mark Air, a major state airline in the 80s, decided to take the little operation on.
And I was called into their office, and they offered to buy me out. And I said, you know, I've been a loner all my life, and I don't intend to change. So, well, then we're going to put you out of business. We're going to fly wingtip to wingtip. And that was the exact words. Everywhere and everything you do.
Not only would Mark Air fly its passengers from Anchorage to King Salmon, but for a dollar more, they'd take them to surrounding villages. But many chose to walk by the Mark Air counter to Penn Air's and pay more. It also did not hurt that Siebert's wife was related to many village residents. But it was the Exxon Valdez oil spill that pulled Penn Air out of the red.
That oil spill kind of saved my bacon. That was at the peak of the Mark Air problem, 89. They were really putting the pressure on us, and it was really getting to us. And I was pretty bad shape. And the day that oil spill happened, within the next week, we had four contracts with Exxon and Vico. And it made a lot of difference that summer.
Siebert's business is now being run by his son, Danny. Others in the family also work for Penn Air, either as pilots or in the office. Siebert expects the company to continue to serve the small communities on the Alaska Peninsula and the Aleutians. He has no plans to expand and become the state's next big airline. He says Penn Air will continue to survive. I'm Johanna Urich.
There were lots of powerful arguments for statehood, and most of the state agreed it would be a pretty good deal for Alaskans. But for the federal government, there were substantial downsides. Not only were there concerns about the military's possible needs for the territory and the changes admitting a new state would bring to the Congress, but Alaska simply did not have much of an economy yet. Where was the assurance that it would not simply continue to be a drag on the federal treasury? Yes, there were hopes for a wood pulp industry, a less extractive salmon fishery, and maybe there could be more mining. The big new economic promise was oil. It had been found at Swanson River on the Kenai Peninsula in 1957. But did anybody really believe extravagant predictions like those delivered in 1958 to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce by W.P. Fuller Browner, president of W.P. Fuller & Company, who said in 50 years in 2008, Alaska's prosperity would be such that its population would have increased to 30 million people? Not only did we get nowhere near that prediction, but in the early years of statehood, there were scant signs of the economic progress the boosters had predicted. Here to help us understand that era is Juno economist Greg Erickson, founder of the Alaska Budget Report. Greg, we've been told that when statehood passed in 1958, the real mainstay of Alaska's economy was actually shrinking. Military spending in Alaska, which had been buoyed up by the Cold War, started falling again because of Sputnik. Suddenly, guided missiles became the threat, and air bases lost some of their priority. Greg, was there an expectation at that time that something else would come along to take the place of that federal spending?
Oh, there's always been a great Alaskan ability to see a silver lining no matter how bad things are. But things were not doing so well in those first year of statehood. Despite the buzz that statehood created, it did create a lot of buzz, and there was a lot of optimism. But if you look beyond that to the number of jobs we had, by the year of statehood, we had lost 18% of the jobs that we'd had in Alaska in 1955. So there were serious problems.
Did they think that Swanson River was going to be bigger than it turned out to be?
In general, I think there was a tendency to overestimate the impact. But in the longer run, building the infrastructure for oil exploration and development and production was probably more important than the actual amount of jobs that it created, because it laid the groundwork for the exploration that later led to the discovery of what was really the big bonanza of the century, Prudhoe Bay.
Well, so here we have statehood and we have Alaska's economy actually headed into the tank. How long did that go on?
Well, strangely enough, it went on until 1964, and the event that was really the key to turning around Alaska's economic situation was a huge natural disaster, the great Alaskan earthquake of March 27th, 1964, which resulted in an inflow of $600 million of federal construction and reconstruction aid. That doesn't sound like very much in today's dollars, but if you translate that into constant dollars and look at it in today's terms, it would be worth $4.5 billion, and that was a huge impact on the economy and resulted in dramatic turnaround. It produced a set of infrastructure in South Central Alaska that was up to date. The highways and bridges and schools that were reconstructed or constructed with that money were up to date. They weren't the old rattle traps that I went to school in at Chugach School, for example. The earthquake made it possible, I think, for the young people to stay and to even a lot of influx of young people occurred after the earthquake because of people. There was a huge need for talented people. And So it changed the character of the demographics of the state as well.
Greg, you really have me wondering now what would have happened if the earthquake had not happened. Have you speculated about that at all?
Well, yeah, I sure have, and I don't know that I have any startling insight. I'm fairly confident we would have muddled through, but it would have certainly been a different place, and one that started out with a much more deteriorated infrastructure and backward infrastructure. So I don't think there's any doubt it would have been a major change. And certainly for those of us who lived here at the time, life would not have been as good if it hadn't been for that earthquake investment.
All right. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Greg Erickson is an economist in Juneau. For the rest of the nation, Alaska is something that is dreamed about. Now it's on reality TV. Before that, it was fictionalized in Northern Exposure. The Iditarod fascinates people all over the world. Walt Disney brought Alaska to the screen. This aura of Alaska goes all the way back to Robert Service and Jack London, and a tradition of scenic painting that melds with the 19th century epic landscapes of the American West. AK's Ellen Lockyer tells us more.
The Alaska Heritage Museum at Wells Fargo Bank in Midtown Anchorage is a gem, small, eclectic, and open to the public. And it houses original oils by artist Sidney Lawrence. Lawrence is noted for his sweeping landscapes, many of Denali. Curator Artemis Bonadilla points to a small Lawrence oil above a bookcase.
This one has a human figure in it, and Sidney Lawrence didn't do a lot of human figures, and they usually are like this, where there's someone building a fire. Sometimes there'll be a cache, a food cache. And I don't know if you saw on the back wall the cave woman.
I love the cave woman.
Well, that
who
is
that?
That's Sidney Lawrence.
No kidding.
And it's quite a mystery.
Who was the cave woman?
Who the cave woman was, why he painted that particular painting. Because, as I said, mostly his people are like you see in this painting, just small, important, but not the focus.
Lawrence's many versions of Denali were well known during his lifetime, but the artist was not always associated with Alaska.
I had two different groups of people from England here, and Sidney Lawrence moved to England and spent about 10 or 12 years in an artist colony there, and they knew of him thinking that he was an English painter. And he, in fact, is really only known in America as an Alaskan painter.
He traveled around Alaska by steamship, sometimes asking the captain to stop so he could sketch.
Ziegler focused on people in Alaska. Mm-hmm.
Jody Jenkins is curator of art education at the Anchorage Museum of History and Art.
We did have artists that accompanied explorers like the Captain Cook's voyage.
She says it wasn't until the 1870s that artists like Lawrence came to Alaska specifically to paint landscapes, giant 12-by-8-foot canvases that helped create a romanticized version of the American West.
Thomas Hill was another artist, which is down here, the big painting.
Let's go see that.
This is Thomas Hill's oils hang mostly in museums today, she says, but his art helped feed a trend that influenced a push for westward expansion at the end of the 19th century. Others, like Cordova's Eustace Ziegler and Ted Lambert, helped to shape a public perception of Alaska as a beckoning wilderness rich in opportunity. The romantic image of Alaska remained until sometime before statehood, when in 1935, young Fred Mokatons flew to Unalakleet to work at his uncle's trading post. He picked up an artist's brush instead and started depicting the daily lives of the Alaska natives he met there. His brightly lit canvases, drenched with pink alpenglow, stand in contrast to Lawrence's unpeopled vision of Alaska. Mokatons' paintings are all about the rugged Inuit of the north, busy hunting, mushing, or harpooning whales. Artemis Bonadilla says Mokatons' life was often hardscrabble.
I mean, he and his wife homesteaded in the Palmer area, lived without running water. It wasn't until a group of Anchorage business people grubstaked him to a year of painting that he really began to paint big, his more monumental pieces.
Mokatons and his wife Sarah made early films of Alaska and showed them on a lower 48 circuit to make enough money to come back here to work every year. Both Lawrence and Mokatons promoted an Alaska dream to a nation hungry for information about Seward's icebox, taking the edge off the frozen image and imbuing the great land with vitality, like Mokatons' Arctic Sentinel, gazing out over a limitless horizon suffused with pastel light. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's AK for this week. Our theme music is by Bamua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org. I'm Steve Heimel.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.